He conjured up an image of himself driving happily down a leafy lane, in a bright pink van with a motif of a red rose on the side. Flowers by Rory. Chapter 12. Nikki walked into her new murder room, her arms piled high with files, to be greeted by the hum of a large photocopier and a 4-foot-high plant that looked like a small palm tree. Where the hell did they come from? Her only answer was a series of shrugs and a chorus of, no idea. When are we expecting the 3-piece suite and fish tank to arrive? No response. Yvonne, how is your old friend, Sergeant Ron Barnes?
Fine, Mum, except he's crippled with arthritis. Between us, we recalled one hell of a lot about the old case. He was chuffed to hear that Gordon hadn't drowned. He always swore he'd only believe it when he saw the fish-nibbled toes.
Lovely. So what did he tell you that we don't know already?
He was living in Yorkshire for quite a few years, Mum, and lost touch with most folks hereabouts. But he did say that the case of the abused children had upset him a great deal. When he came back to Greenborough earlier this year, he saw one of the girls, now in her 40s, working in a local cafe. He tried to speak to her, but she pretended not to recognise him. He didn't press her. She seemed very strange. It set him wondering about the other kids. Had they been permanently damaged, or had they left it behind and got on with their lives?
Dave smiled. Once a copper, always a copper, huh? He must be near the 80 by now.
And still sharp as a stiletto, believe me, said Yvonne. But here's the thing. He found 4 of them living right here in Greenborough. One still in Quinton Ordyke, one lives in Skegness, one in West Saltaby, one had taken an overdose, and one he cannot trace. He's given me a list of the names and addresses. Reckons he's really glad to hand it over to the professionals. He'd started to ferret around in a very limited way, and he didn't like what he was digging up.
Added to the one provided by the doctor and his wife, it'll be enough for us to start making some inquiries. Nikki took the handwritten sheet and stared at it. The child he could not find was Millicent Cartwright, of course, and we're having a spot of bother finding her ourselves. She shook her head. I'm not used to being handed information on a plate. It's quite disconcerting.
Nikki told them what Linda Draper had overheard.
We will check out the 4 names and addresses in Greenborough first, then we'll go check the outlying ones this afternoon. We'll work in pairs, Kat and Yvonne, and Joseph and myself. Ben, you keep hunting for the Cartwright girl, and Dave, you can run the office and give Ben a hand if he needs it.
She turned to Kat and Joseph.
I've copied the Draper notes for each of you. I suggest you read what they say about your particular witness, and I don't have to tell you to be tactful. Kat, you take Lucy Clark. According to this, she works for the Tasty Toasty in Herring Lane. Her home address is there, too. You can also try George Aykroyd. We only have a home address for him, so play that one by ear, okay? Joseph, we'll look for Delia Roberts and Terry Harvey.
The woman stared at Kat and shook her head. No, she could not possibly talk to them. She was far too busy. Her manageress would not like it one bit. She could lose her job. Her skin was pasty and her eyes were wide, the pupils too large for the bright lights of the cafe. Kat spoke calmly. She had done nothing wrong. They simply wanted her help with something. While Kat talked, Yvonne took the manageress aside and asked if she had somewhere quiet where they could talk to Lucy privately. She assured her that they only wanted some information regarding an old case. Lucy was not in any kind of trouble. The cafe manager offered the use of her sitting room above the cafe. Finally, they all managed to coax the frightened woman upstairs. Lucy Clark sat opposite them, looking tiny and frail in the big, wing-backed armchair. Her hands fluttered continually and her pupils dilated. Yvonne adopted her best motherly tone and began the questions. Yes, she was indeed Lucy Clark, daughter of Anne Clark of Quinton Ordyke. She now lived in permanent accommodation in 5 Gate Lane in Greenborough. When Yvonne asked her why she had left home, Lucy stuttered and finally said that she and her mother didn't get on.
Now, Lucy, we don't want to distress you in any way, but we need to talk to you about a family who lived in Quinton when you were a child. Would you please help us and tell us what you know?
Lucy wrung her hands together. Her knuckle bones showed white beneath her skin, and her eyes darted about the room as if she were looking for a means of escape.
The family were called Hammond. Do you remember them?
She nodded and chewed on her bottom lip.
Was Avril Hammond a friend of yours? She must have been about the same age as you. Maybe a little older.
Lucy swallowed. We weren't friends. She wasn't in my class.
She disappeared, didn't she?
They said her father killed her and buried her out on the fen, then drowned himself. She spoke in a monotone, as if the words had been learned by rote. Gordon Hammond did not drown, Lucy. Yvonne paused. The tiny woman began to shiver. It's all right, Lucy. He is dead. We know that for sure. The thing is, he was murdered, and we need to know everything we can about him.
Dead?
Yes. He can't hurt anyone any more. Yvonne waited a moment. Did he ever hurt you, Lucy? She leapt up so fast that Yvonne and Kat jumped. I have to get back to work. I can't answer your questions. It was too long ago. I don't remember. Go away! Spit dribbled down her chin. Please, won't you leave me alone?
It's all right, Lucy. You go back to work. We only wanted you to know that he's gone, okay? We do need to find who killed him, so if you can think of anything that could help us...
Kat handed her a card.
Just ask for Kat, and we won't hassle you, I promise.
That went well. She's on something. Some heavy prescription drug, I reckon. Her nerves are shot to pieces, said Yvonne. I had noticed, Bonnie. I nearly had a coronary when she jumped up like that. Phew! I'm not sure what to make of it, are you?
Yvonne shook her head.
Frankly, no. And we don't even know if her condition is due to something else. An illness, perhaps, or is it directly related to having been abused?
Well, I can hardly wait for our next interview, can you? Who is it, George Aykroyd?
Kat looked at the list.
Yes, let's hope he's out.
George Aykroyd was in. He was always in.
Agoraphobia, Mr. Aykroyd. I'm sorry to hear that. How do you manage? You live alone, don't you?
Yvonne looked genuinely concerned. He spoke so quietly that Kat had to move closer to hear him.
I've managed for 15 years now. It happened after my father died. My mother passed away when I was very small, and my dad was everything to me. I had a breakdown when he went.
What about shopping? Do you have friends that help you?
Yvonne asked.
I go out when it's dark and quiet. I can face empty streets, although I can't go far. The mini-mart on the corner of Churchill Avenue stays open until midnight. I get my food there. They're very nice people. Rabbi even delivers if I have a bad spell and can't get out at all.
Kat looked at his clean but faded and unfashionable clothes. No browsing the menswear departments for George Aykroyd.
Do you work? From home, I mean?
No, I get some benefits, enough to live on. The rent is low and I don't spend much.
You can say that again, thought Kat. The flat was little more than a bedsit and the furnishings were basic, to say the least.
What happened to your father's house? Did you sell it when he died?
He looked at her sadly.
Our home was a tied cottage belonging to the Bromley estate. It's a big farm on the seaward side of Quinton. As I wasn't employed by the estate, the cottage was forfeit and it was returned to the Bromleys.
Mr. Aykroyd, can we ask you some questions about Quinton O'Dyke? You see, a man that we've identified as a Gordon Hammond has been found murdered. We believe that you lived in the village at the same time as he and his family did.
Kat watched for his reactions while Yvonne spoke. Apart from a slight quiver of an eyelid, he remained impassive.
There was some trouble in the village back in the late '70s, early '80s. Hammond apparently abused some children. There were other things like missing and dead pets, I think. Luckily, I was not involved. It ended when his daughter died and we all thought that he had killed himself. You're saying that we were wrong?
Avril went missing and is now presumed dead, and someone murdered Gordon.
The tick made him rub his eye, but he said nothing.
You were, as you say, very lucky.
Yvonne's voice was almost as soft as George Aykroyd's.
Indeed, very lucky.
Have you any idea who might have killed him, Mr. Aykroyd?
No, but as he was the most hated man in Quinton O'Dyke, I should think you will find a lot of suspects.
George's pallor reminded Kat of some of the prisoners she had interviewed. She supposed this man was almost a prisoner too, in his way. His only privilege was a 500-yard nocturnal walk to Ravi's mini-mart. Some of the scum inside had it better. Yvonne handed him a card.
If you think of anything, Mr. Aykroyd, anything at all, you can contact us on that number, WPC Collins or DC Cullen.
George Aykroyd took the card. With a bitter smile, he said,
I try hard not to think about Quinton O'Dyke, Constable.
The door closed behind the two policewomen. George leaned with his whole weight against the door. Then he straightened up, locked and bolted it, and fastened the security chain. He had thought it would happen one day, but as the months had turned into years, he had dared to believe that it had gone away. He trudged heavily to his bedroom, and, fully clothed, he slipped into his bed and pulled the duvet over his head. No, he couldn't hide from the memory. who was already crawling back into his mind. George gave a little whimper of anguish. It was too late to hide. He was crying, and his face was smeared with mud. There was an ugly red welt scorched into his wrist.
"I'll never tell, I promise. I'll never tell."
He knew his voice came out tremulous and fearful, but there was no way he could be brave any more. He tried to pull himself up, but he was kicked back into the wet ground. His face was pushed down into the muddy soil, and words were lost. He swallowed earth. A sharp, flinty stone sliced into his cheek, but he was so afraid he hardly felt it.
"Oh, you won't tell, my lad, because you know what'll happen to you, don't you?"
The hand took hold of his hair and yanked his head back so he had to look up.
"You do know, don't you?"
He spat the earth from his mouth and choked out the words.
"Yes, yes, I know, I know."
Then his attacker knelt down beside him, and, still gripping his hair, whispered into his ear. He'd never forget those words. He felt sick. He thought he was going to faint. Blood was running down his cheek. He must have fainted for a moment because he found himself alone. He dragged himself further into the bushes at the edge of the field. He just curled up and rocked backwards and forwards. He couldn't do anything else. Then he realized that it was getting dark, so he found his way back to his bicycle. It hurt to lift the old black bike from the thorny hedgerow. He went slowly down the track towards the main road, wondering what to tell his dad. His school blazer was torn and dirty, and there was blood and muck on his white shirt. He just couldn't think. His mind was numb. He only had one pair of school shoes, two pairs of uniform trousers, one short and one long, and one blazer. He tried to stop himself from crying again. Even if his dad clouted him, shut him in his room, stopped his pocket money forever, nothing, nothing would be as bad as what had just happened. And the worst thing of all, apart from that voice in his ear, was a dark stain on the front of his torn and dirty pants. George curled into a tight ball beneath the duvet and sobbed, until he could hardly breathe. The nightmare was back. Now he knew that he couldn't ever make it go away. Kat and Yvonne arrived back at the murder room not long after Nicky and Joseph.
"I hope your interviews went better than ours, Mom."
Kat pulled a face.
"Well, that depends. You had no luck with either of them."
Kat stared at her notebook.
"One is strung tighter than a guitar, and the other one is an agoraphobic with bad clothes sense and a nervous tic. How about you?"
Nicky looked at Joseph and raised an eyebrow.
"We were just wondering how Delia Roberts, divorced, no children and a workaholic, managed to answer every question put to her and tell us absolutely nothing at all."
"Was she a flake?"
"Not at all, Kat. She came across as a well-groomed, well-spoken, hard-working career woman. She was just totally uninformative."
"In a verbose and helpful manner," added Joseph. "It was weird. I thought it was me until I saw Nicky's face."
"And Terry Harvey declined to speak to us. Well, his very pregnant wife told us to fuck off, so same difference."
"I thought I recognized the name, and I've just run a check on him." Joseph read from a memo. "Drugs offences mainly, shoplifting, handbag snatching, and two of his many children are in care."
"Well, if this morning is anything to go by, there's little prospect of an exciting afternoon."
Nicky looked at the remaining names.
"I suggest we have lunch, and Joseph and I go to Skegness and speak to Sally Gilmore, and Kat and Yvonne search out the other two in West Salterby and Quinton O'Dyke."
"We've drawn the short straw, Kat. No cockles for you today."
Yvonne hung her head in mock dismay.
"I wouldn't be too sure about the length of the straw, Vonnie."
Nicky smiled, but her eyes were serious. Dr. Draper was convinced that the Gilmore girl was sexually abused, and her father was strongly in favour of the villagers taking things into their own hands. They all looked at the doctor's notes.
"Found by two other children in the churchyard. She was in a state of agitation and distress, her clothes torn and bloodstained. They took her home, where she declared that she had been attacked by a black dog. No trace of any such animal was found. Linda saw the three children as they made their way into the Gilmores' cottage. She noticed the blood on the lower part of Sally's torn dress, but Bert Gilmore said it was nothing, not as bad as it looked, and closed the door on her. Sally became sullen and uncommunicative in the following months, rarely leaving home and often playing truant from school. Neither Linda nor I ever noticed anything in the way of bite marks or defensive wounds on the child. We suppose the dog attack to be a fabrication, and from the condition of her torn clothing, that she had been sexually attacked."
Kat lowered the sheet of paper and sighed.
"I wonder what state she will be in."
Nicky glanced up at the newly arrived wall clock.
Let's get lunch, shall we? We'll soon find out.
Yvonne pulled into the small deserted car park behind West Saltoby Police Station. It was a grand title for a building about the size of a public convenience. The station consisted of an office, a tiny kitchenette, and a store cupboard. Manned by a single officer, it was only open for a few hours each day. This officer spent the rest of his time policing a tiny population spread across acres of empty farmland and marsh. No wonder PC Steve Royal wanted out.
"Lorsky me," said Steve in a bad imitation of the local accent. "Visitation from CID. Whatever's happened? Someone selling black market cauliflowers in Greenborough Street Market?"
Yvonne nodded to the tall, muscular copper.
"Hello, Steve. No, nothing agricultural this time. We just wanted a word with a chap who lives in the village here. Fellow called Peter Lee, do you know him?"
Steve ran a tanned hand through his cropped hair, and his cheerful expression disappeared.
"Yes, I know him. In fact, I'm trying to settle a dispute between him and his neighbour, hopefully before it turns nasty."
"What's it about?" asked Cat.
"A caravan. You know what it's like out here, D.C. Cullen. Nearly every bit of empty ground has a rotting static on it somewhere. They use them for everything and anything. Putting up casual workers, storing seed trays, breeding canaries, place to put your spare tractor parts, you name it. Peter Lee's neighbour uses his as a dog kennel for his old boxer bitch. Lee reckons it's an eyesore and wants it moved."
"Is he being reasonable?"
"No way. The caravan isn't anywhere near his boundary, and it's not a wreck either. He's just a grumpy old sod. If it wasn't that, it would be something else."
Cat looked surprised.
"Surely he's only in his early 40s.
"Yeah, going on 95. What do you want to talk to him about, anyway?"
"The Hammond case," said Yvonne. "You know, that 30-year-old murder."
"I bet he did it, Bonnie. And he wouldn't have needed a weapon, either. He would have bored them to death."
Cat grinned.
"Want to come with us, Constable, seeing as how he's such a pal of yours?"
"Love to. But I've just remembered an important case I have to deal with. Some cunning devil has been stealing organic parsnips and using them for highly immoral purposes."
Steve's face remained impassive. Cat looked at him.
"You are joking."
"You can never be sure around here."
Steve rolled his eyes.
"Lee lives in the row of detached cottages behind the bakery. Good luck."
Peter Lee examined their IDs minutely, and immediately launched into a long diatribe about his neighbour and his caravan. It took Yvonne some time to explain that they were here to talk to him about Gordon Hammond. The stream of words dried up. Peter Lee pursed his narrow lips and stared belligerently from one to the other. Over his front gate, they were allowed no further. He told them they should find better things to do with their time. He turned his back on them, went into his old cottage, and slammed the door. Cat studied the overgrown garden, the fish pond full of rotting leaves and the peeling paintwork.
"He's rude, bad-tempered, angry, and he's terrified. Did you see his face when you mentioned finding Gordon's body? This is all very odd, isn't it?"
"That it is,"
Yvonne sighed.
"One last visit, and if Sarah Archer tells us to bugger off as well, we'll have a full house of failures."
They were pleasantly surprised when Sarah Archer welcomed them in and offered them tea. She plumped up cushions and fussed around while they waited to take their seats. It took Cat 2 minutes and Yvonne about 2.5 to realise that she was, well, barking mad. Her parents, both still alive, were away for the day in Lincoln, Sarah said. She proceeded to give the two officers a tour of the house and garden. Every room was clean, tidy, and fresh-smelling. Proudly, Sarah opened the door to her bedroom. Arranged around a small single bed, with a pink and white duvet set, were teddy bears, dolls, and soft toys. They filled the shelves and sat on chairs on the floor. Some even hung from the ceiling. Yvonne and Cat said little. They didn't need to. Their hostess gabbled away without a break. The large garden was a live version of the bedroom, filled with hutches, pens, and kennels. Dogs, cats, rabbits, guinea pigs, a chinchilla, chicken, and even a fox cub stared back at them from quarters clean as the cottage. Eventually, Yvonne managed to convey the reason for their visit, but this child in a woman's body looked blankly at them. She was sorry, but she'd never heard of anyone called Hammond. On their way back to Greenborough, Cat reread Dr. Draper's notes on Sarah Archer, aged 6. "We only found out a month after the occurrence, so it was impossible to investigate, but Sarah had gone missing for an entire day and night. She was found out on the edge of Carter's Fen, in a concrete pillbox, one of those left over from the war. Apparently her wrists and ankles had been secured with twine.
We never heard what injuries she sustained. Nothing was apparent when we saw her later. She too joined the ever-growing ranks of silent, frightened, introspective children in Quinton O'Dyke.
"You would hardly call her silent now, would you?"
said Yvonne. Cat closed her file and stared out across the endless fields of sugar beet foliage.
"Bonnie, in our job we see it all the time. People suffer terrible traumas. They have the most appalling things done to them, suffer unspeakable tragedies. But somehow they get over them. In order to survive, they find a way to come to terms with the past. Believe me, I'm not trying to belittle what happened, but we've met hundreds of survivors of abuse, and at least outwardly some of them appear normal. What is it with all these guys? They are completely destroyed, every one of them."
"Let's save the analysis for the debriefing, shall we?" Yvonne was watching the long, straight road ahead.
"I gather, WPC Yvonne Collins, that you don't have a bleeding clue either."
"None whatsoever, Detective Constable. I'm just hoping the boss still has a few grey cells functioning, because I'm damn sure mine aren't."
Joseph stared once more at the makeshift evidence board and rubbed his eyes hard.
"So, what we have is one, maybe two, lucid and sane witnesses. I'd stick to just the one."
Nicky pointed to the board.
"I still think this one, the apparently normal and capable Delia Roberts, is a bloody good actress. I was suspicious of the way she avoided giving any direct answers. So, to summarise, out of 7 adults, 4 females and 3 males, we have 1 nervous wreck, 1 agoraphobic, 1 drug addict, 1 middle-aged woman behaving like a 9-year-old, an aggressive recluse, a workaholic who can't answer questions, and, praise be, Mrs. Sally King, née Gilmore, a happily married mother of 2. She is a very helpful and pleasant care worker, who is at present during a 3-year course on people-centred counselling. As far as we can make out, of all of them, she's the one who has every reason to be totally off the wall."
Joseph massaged his aching neck.
"Apart from her, they're all displaying signs of trauma, denial, and even fear."
"Of someone who has been dead for 30 years? Why?"
Cat bit her thumbnail.
Yvonne shrugged. "To be fair, they only hoped he was dead. Nobody ever proved that he had drowned. Maybe it was the not knowing that got to them."
"Maybe, Yvonne, but these are adults, for heaven's sake. Aren't children supposed to be resilient? Kids usually find a way to cope, even if they bury the hurt or pain really deep. Most learn to get on with their lives. They have to."
Cat's voice shook with emotion.
"You have to, or the abuser wins. And if that happens..."
She threw up her hands and fell silent. The others were also silent for a moment, and then Joseph said softly,
"That sounds like it came from the Personal Experience School of Psychology."
"It's from the Shit Happens School, actually."
Cat looked down. Nicky steered them back to practicalities.
"Next step is to interview the remaining parents. The man that intrigued me most is Quinton's old master butcher, Cyril Roberts, as well as his ex-wife. I'll be very interested to know what he says when he hears his old friend was murdered. I'd like to find out if he really did suspect someone else of the child abuse. So tomorrow morning, bright and early, unless we're back with Madeline Prospero, we take on Quinton O'Dyke's older generation."
The others departed, leaving Nicky and Joseph by themselves in the big old mess room.
"What time did Tamsin and Niall get in?"
Joseph glanced at his watch.
"In about 30 minutes. They'll have to clear customs and drive back here, so I expect they'll be in their cottage by 10:30, if nothing goes wrong."
"Are you going to welcome them?" Nicky asked. He grinned.
"No way. Their first night in their marital home. Are you kidding?
So, is this our big chance to grab a takeaway and a bottle of vino?"
His face clouded over. Nicky saw it and threw him a lifeline.
"Sorry, I take that back. I forgot. I'm calling into Eve's after work. She'll probably have something rustled up."
She smiled at him, hurting inside.
"Another night, huh?"
He nodded.
"Absolutely. As soon as possible."
He stared down at his feet.
"I am getting somewhere with Laura. I think she's beginning to realise that she can't use me as a crutch and that she has to move on."
His voice was despondent,
but not quickly enough for my liking.
"That makes 2 of us," thought Nicky grimly.
"Do what you need to, Joseph, and remember, you know where I am if you need me."
"I'm sorry, Nicky. This is not of my making. You do know that, don't you?"
Nicky thought she had never seen him look so miserable.
"Of course I do, numpty. Now, pin back your ears and listen while I tell you about a certain invite my mother's just had. It could be very fortunate for us."
Nicky was in mid-flow, when she heard a knock at the door.
"Come."
Spooky stuck her head in and whistled. "My, your decor goes from strength to strength, doesn't it?" "Come on in, Terence Conran." Nicky peered at her face, and then she grinned. "You got it, didn't you?" "I sure did. Get out that champagne right now." Joseph stood up. "I'll leave you two to chat. See you in the morning. Crack of dawn, so we can take on Quint and Ordite before they're fully awake." "I'll be here." He gave Spooky a little bow. "Congratulations. I'm sure we'll be seeing a lot of you from now on."
"As long as my accommodation is a little more up-to-date than Nicky's."
Joseph laughed. "You should be all right. The rest of the building was rebuilt, more nice and modern. It's just us that have an ancient ruin."
"And if you do get an old stockroom, try to think of it as character building," said Nicky.
"Sod that. I've got quite enough character, thanks. What I need is big power cables and racks of servers." Spooky laughed. "Actually, I've seen the rooms and they are great. I can't wait to get started."
She looked at Nicky. "And now I need to get home to give Bliss the good news. I just had to let you know first."
"Before you go, I need to run something past you. Can you stay for just a few minutes?"
Spooky sat down.
"Is it about Maddie?"
"Kind of. The thing is, someone quite close to me has had an informal invite to go along to the Briar Patch. Would you keep an eye on her for me? She's new to the area and no one knows she has a connection to the police force. She could be a very valuable asset."
Spooky nodded.
"Of course. Any idea who invited her?"
"A member who belongs to an art club, Grace Campion."
She's a great landscape artist. And she does go to a Greenborough art group. How do you want me to play it?"
"I'll tell her about you, just so she knows who to contact if she needs any help. But other than that, just keep watch. If you get too friendly, they might suspect something."
"Understood. Just let me know when she plans on going and I'll make sure I'm there."
"Brilliant. Now go tell Bliss that you were gainfully employed at the cop shop."
Nicky stood up.
"Meanwhile, I'll go and see my new secret agent and show her a photo of you."
"I didn't know you had one."
"That time we won the Culpeper Badminton Trophy, doubles match against Sultan Le Fen."
"Good Lord, I'd almost forgotten that."
Spooky paused in the doorway.
"Oh, what's this woman's name?"
"Eve Anderson."
"Nice name. Nice woman. Take care of her."
Dr. Draper sank into an old armchair and looked up at his wife.
"I wish this Hammond thing hadn't reared its ugly head again."
"I don't suppose you were the only one to think that, dear. There's one person in particular who'll be very worried by all the renewed attention."
He screwed up his brow.
"Oh, who?"
"Whoever killed Gordon, of course."
"You really think he is still here?"
Linda shrugged.
"Who knows? The older ones rarely stray too far, do they?"
She touched her husband's shoulder.
"I'm going to get supper. You have a rest and I'll call you when it's ready."
John Draper wondered if they would ever get to the bottom of it all. He stared into the fire and was back there again, sitting in his surgery and looking across his desk to a very angry man.
"Doctor, I know my child."
The patient, Bert Gilmore, slammed a clenched fist down onto his desktop and his stethoscope jumped in the air. A pile of patients' records went cascading down onto the floor. He picked them up slowly, giving the man time to calm down. Then he sat back in his chair and surveyed the florid, wide-eyed face. Bert's jaw protruded. It was clamped so tight that his lips, chapped by the wind, could hardly be seen. Bert was the third parent this month to come to him for a wonder pill, some miracle tonic that would restore their sullen, uncommunicative offspring to their former mischievous selves. He sighed. He wished he had such an elixir to ease their pain. He dearly wanted to help the children, but he was dealing with distraught and poorly educated mothers and fathers. Their outlook was almost medieval.
"I'm sorry, Bert. I don't have anything I can give her. We need to make her tell us what is wrong. We have to find out what the underlying problem is before I can do anything to help her."
Bert Gilmore expelled a lungful of air and slumped forward, his head in his hands.
"She won't talk. Not to her ma'am, not to her brothers, and certainly not to me."
His voice was hoarse and he spoke slowly.
"Can I try, Bert? Would you let me talk to her, away from you and the family? I'd have Mrs. Draper with me. Perhaps she might open up to us."
Bert's eyes narrowed.
"What? And use some of your newfangled mind games on her? I've read about all that malarkey in the papers, hypnotism and the like. She's not balmy, you know. It's probably just growing pains, nothing that a good tonic wouldn't fix.
The eyes were pleading.
You know full well it isn't growing pains, Bert, and I just want to talk to her. That's all. Get her to trust me. Then she might tell me what happened.
He had been down this road before, first with Fred and Ellen Cartwright, then with Bill and Lily Harvey. Both times he was met with the same suspicious expressions. Apparently overnight, Millie Cartwright, Terry Harvey, and now Sally Gilmore had withdrawn like hermit crabs into their shells, shutting out their bewildered parents, who had no idea what had happened. He added these cases to the vicious attack on Lucy Clark the previous month, and Sergeant Ron Barnes's off-the-record suspicion that little George Ackroyd had been interfered with, and he became certain that the villagers of Sleepy Quinton O'Dyke had a child molester in their midst.
"Please, Bert, let me try. If something is happening to the village kids, we have to know what it is, don't we? For the sake of all the others out there who may be in danger."
Bert Gilmore pushed back his chair and stood up abruptly.
"I'll come here for some help with my girl's problems, not to be told something's happened to her, like. And if something funny were going on, then we'd deal with it ourselves, right?"
He strode to the door and yanked it open.
"You're nowt but a scaremonger, Doctor. Most likes me and my family will be seeing old Doc Parkins out at West Alterby in future."
The slam resounded loudly through the old house. Gilmore's noisy departure was very like the Cartwrights, but not quite as earth-shattering as that of Bill Harvey and his wife.
"Bloody place. Nothing's damn well changed here since the blasted Dark Ages. I might as well buy a tank of leeches and start prescribing herbs picked only during a full moon."
His wife peeked around the door.
"Thank God he was your last patient. Do you need the screwdriver for the door handle again, dear?"
He gave her a wry smile.
"Not this time, Linda. Bert didn't have quite the heft of Bill Harvey. But then again, Bill farms potatoes, and that's heavier work than gutting fish."
He stared down at his notes.
"What am I going to do, Lynn? How do I get through to these people?"
His wife moved round and gently massaged his aching shoulders.
"Gently. You have to be very persistent, I think. They will come around, John, but I suspect it will take some terrible tragedy to make them face the fact that we have a real problem here in the village."
"Something like what happened to Lucy Clark."
"Or worse."
"That's what Sarge Barnes reckons."
He leant back and stretched his neck.
"Bit to the left. Oh, yes, that's it. Oh, by the way, did you have any luck getting to speak with Ellen Cartwright? You two were on the same stall at the Bring and Buy sale, weren't you?"
"She swapped for the tombola."
"So they don't trust you either?"
"They don't trust anyone, John, and they're scared."
"If we do have a pervert out there, then they have every reason to be scared. If only one of the children would have the courage to say something."
"Would you, if you had Bill Harvey for a father?"
"Probably not. And I certainly wouldn't if the person that terrorised me was right here in the community, and maybe even knew my parents."
"Exactly. And you're not a little 7-year-old kid, are you?"
He took her hand and turned to face her.
"Youngsters usually try to blot it out, pretend it never happened. I hoped I would have a chance to get through to one of the children, but it doesn't look as if I'm going to get one, does it?"
"Chin up, darling. All you can do is be there for them when they come running back to you, which they will. No one is going to travel all that way out to West Salterby if they feel groggy, especially when they know that dear Dr. Parkins might well be pisseder than you when they get there. They also know that you are a damned good doctor. They just don't want to hear the truth right now."
She smiled sadly.
"Just have patience, darling."
"But do I have the time? This village is a powder keg and the next attack could be fatal."
Linda didn't answer him. John Draper sat upright in his chair. He just hoped that whoever was now in charge had the gumption to take this old case and give it a bloody good shake. The truth should be uncovered, once and for all. It had lain hidden for far too long, just like Gordon Hammond's mouldering body. Father Aidan removed his old leather jacket and flung it over the back of his worn and threadbare settee. He felt cold and tired, more like frozen and exhausted, actually. He sat down heavily, jolting his back on the wooden struts beneath the foam seating, and wishing he had the luxury of a housekeeper like Father Brendan in the neighbouring parish of Silk Linnington. After spending half the day working on the overgrown churchyard and the other half writing a sermon, he was too tired to cook. His heart sank when he heard someone knock on the vicarage door.
He really did not think he had the energy to listen to a recitation of some parishioner's troubles. He sighed. It was his job, no, his calling, to be there for his flock. He reprimanded himself for being so weak. He struggled up and summoned up the strength to smile. A glance in the hall mirror reflected a benevolent priestly face. Good. Straightening his aching back, he opened the front door to... nothing.
Hello?
Darkness and silence surrounded him. The hall light spilt across empty stones.
Hello? Is there anyone there? I'm sorry if I took a long time to answer the door.
The strong wind had eased off, and now all he heard was the whisper of a breeze through the shrubs and trees that flanked the pathway. He pulled the door to and walked down to the gate. The light from the moon revealed his neighbour's cat slinking beneath the hedge, and white plastic bag danced in the air. Father Aidan walked back to his front door and paused. Had he actually heard a knock at all? Maybe the wind had blown something over in the garden. If he had been less tired, he would have checked. He was about to go in when he looked through the side gate that led to the churchyard, and saw a light flicker. From the way it bobbed and weaved, he thought it could be a torch. He ran into the house and turned on the outside garden lights. He then retrieved his own big flashlight from the kitchen and grabbed his jacket. At the side gate, he slowed his pace and looked around. He could see no movement. He swung the powerful beam from his lamp over the crosses and stones, searching for a sign of life among the dead. He was not afraid. People never came here in the dark of night. The church had a reputation, so whoever was traipsing through the churchyard must be up to no good. And then he thought, why knock on my door and announce your presence in the first place? He made his way to the Norman arch over the church door. The door was still locked, and he saw no one lurking in the shadows of the porch. He walked around the old building, the beam of his torch illuminating the carved words on the gravestones, in loving memory, departed this life, rest in peace. After 20 minutes he returned to the vicarage, made himself a strong coffee, and poured himself a stronger drink. His evening supper consisted of a cheese sandwich and an aging banana. He went to bed at 11, prayed for 10 minutes, and then had another whiskey. He decided to leave the outside light on.
Chapter 13 After an early breakfast, Nicky and her team were preparing for their visit to Quinton O'Dyke when the phone rang. Joseph took it.
Sorry, Nicky, but I think you'll want to take this. It's Father Aidan from St. Augustine's again.
Bloody hell, he hasn't found another murdered murderer, has he?
Kat dropped her clipboard onto the desk and stood waiting.
Father Aidan, good morning, and what can we do for you?
Then her smile faded, and she beckoned to Kat.
D.C. Cullen will come straight over. Leave it where you found it, Father. Cover it if you think it best. You know, children seeing it.
Nicky hung up, looking slightly uneasy.
Kat, it may be nothing, probably some bored little tour rags with a nasty sense of humour, but check it out anyway. You know where to go.
What's the poor sod found this time, Mom?
Rabbits. Dead rabbits placed on the site of Gordon Hammond's unofficial grave.
Oh, great. Just after breakfast, too.
Sorry, Kat, but under the circumstances it has to be investigated. Ring me when you've taken a look. I'll go on with the others. If it turns out to be nothing, then catch us up in Quinton. If not, we'll see you back here.
Not exactly the work of the local fox, is it, Father?
Kat said.
Not unless he's discovered how to use a sharp knife,
Father Aidan replied.
When did you find it?
Kat listened to the young priest's account of the previous night's events. Just after dawn, he had gone out to check in case the tombstones or the church had been vandalised.
It's no coincidence that it's Hammond's temporary resting place, is it?
No, Father. Your dissected bunny and his friends are definitely here for a reason. Look, I'm going to have to get some photographs. Normally I'd just say get rid of it, but because of the situation, I'd like to keep a record. We may need a photographer to come out, and I'd better let the governor know.
The priest carefully draped 2 black bin bags over the macabre tableau, while Kat rang Nicky.
Mom, some sick git has gutted 1 rabbit and staked it out, biology lesson style, and beheaded a couple of other bunnies, and carefully placed them all over the area of Hammond's grave. Oh, hang on, Mom, the priest is calling me.
With the phone in one hand, she returned to the grave, where Father Aidan was pointing to something in the bushes.
Looks like there's a note, Mom. It's scribbled in black felt pen on a big piece of card. It says, Lest We Forget, in capital letters. There are 2 rough holes in the top and a bit of bloody string dangling from it. I think it may have been attached to our dead bunny display, but the wind blew it into the bushes.
Nicky told her to bag the message, It was not sufficiently important to warrant turning out a forensic photographer or a soaker, but Kat should take photos and carefully check the scene in case something else had been left. Kat and the priest searched carefully for nearly half an hour, but found nothing else. Father Aidan made them both coffee, while Kat took photos on her smartphone and sent them back to Dave to print off. She took the luckless priest's statement and helped him to bag up the remains.
"Anything else that you see or hear, Father, just call us. I don't think you should be chasing around in the dark. Whoever filleted Bugs Bunny might turn to you next time. You never know these days, so be careful, okay?"
By midday, Nicky, Joseph and Yvonne felt as if the villagers of Quinton O'Dyke had built a brick wall around themselves. They had been told to go away in various terms. The last one, Bill Harvey, had expressed his irritation at seeing them by answering the door with a broken shotgun over his arm. No one wanted to help with their inquiries. No one cared that Gordon Hammond had been murdered, and no one wanted to remember.
"Just your butcher now. Cyril Roberts."
Joseph crossed another name off the list. "I wonder if he will be any more interested in seeing us than his wife was." He frowned.
"I'm sure she didn't have to be that rude."
Nicky shook her head. "They've all lost their children. For whatever reason, every single one of them has left. It's no wonder the parents are bitter."
"I suppose so. Well, let's see how Gordon's only friend feels about his murder."
"God, this awful place reminds me of..."
Yvonne's words faded into silence. Nobody spoke. Then Nicky said, "I thought so too at first, Yvonne. Lonely, difficult to find, looks derelict from a distance. But no, it's not like that awful case. He is making an effort here." Indeed, they could see a few straggly pot plants bravely holding out against the wind. The garage doors had recently been mended, and the Toyota pickup in the yard was moderately clean. There was washing blowing on the line, and the net curtains were almost white. Cyril Roberts was waiting for them.
"I wondered when you'd come."
He opened the door, and they trooped inside.
"Have a seat. I saw Doc Draper. He said Gordon had been done for, so knew you'd be here soon. Didn't think it'd take three of you, though."
Nicky introduced the others and looked around. It was pretty spartan, but clean and tidy. She was surprised to see several bookcases stuffed with an eclectic mix of reading matter, ranging from Tolstoy to Rupert Bear. This balding, overweight man did not look like a typical bookworm. "We had planned on conducting a number of interviews, Mr. Roberts, but the inhabitants of Quinton are less than willing to talk to us."
"Your ex-wife in particular," added Joseph.
Robert snorted.
"You should have come out here first. I could have saved you a lot of time, and most likely an ear bashing in my wife's case.
Want tea?"
"I can make a pot if you like."
Nicky declined. "We'll cut to the chase, as they say, Mr. Roberts. Do you have any idea what happened to Gordon Hammond?" Roberts sat down in an old Lloyd Loom chair and took a deep breath.
"The men of Quinton O'Dyke. They wanted to sort it. They had no proof. They put two and two together and made five, and Gordon was the perfect candidate, poor fool. He didn't drink much, and he hated chitter-chatter, and even I had to admit he changed after his boy died.
Dr. Draper mentioned an accident.
Gordon was weeding the sugar beet field. He had young Matthew with him, and his dog, Snowler. He sent Matt to clear some stones away from the jag arrow at back. Matt yelled for him to help him, because there was a rock jammed in the tines. Gordon left the tractor ticking and the dog in it, and went to help the lad. They cleared it between them, and then Matt saw another chunk of rock. He leaned across to free it. Gordon reckoned the dog must have jumped out and knocked the gears somehow. His boy got his jacket caught in the tines and was dragged under."
Nicky felt slightly queasy. She knew the size and weight of tractor ties, and the kind of horribly dangerous equipment they pulled to till and clear the ground.
"That weren't the end of it, neither. Gordon had some kind of nervous breakdown. It was also said, although she never admitted it, that Avril had witnessed her brother's death."
He paused.
"If she did. Well, can you imagine it? Anyway, I'm digressing. Gordon had a wicked temper, all right. Put that with Glad's lifelong habit of falling over and bashing herself, and the good men of Quinton named him a wife beater. In their book, that was only one step away from molesting children, and from there to being a killer."
Cyril looked scornful.
"As if."
"You still don't believe he hurt all those children? And if he didn't, Mr. Roberts, someone else did. They're as disturbed today as they were then, which is odd in itself. So who?"
Cyril stared at the old black boiler. He stood up,
lifted the top lid using a metal hook, and shook in some dusty coal. He replaced the lid and sat back down.
"I had my thoughts, Inspector, back then. I thought I knew."
There was a catch in his voice. "Who did you think it was?"
"You see, they were so fixated on Gordon, they never looked any further. Except Doc Draper. I think he was probably my only ally. At least he listened to me. The other buggers didn't."
Nicky was beginning to grow impatient. "Mr. Roberts?"
"I'm sorry. Really I am, but when Avril died, all my thoughts came to nothing."
"Mr. Roberts, she was never found. You know that?"
"Whatever. One night I saw Gordon go out to the fen with a heavy bag. When he came back an hour later, it was empty. There was blood on his coat the next day. I don't know what it was, but after that I had to admit he was just not himself. I blamed the men of the village. I did then and I do now. If he did do something dreadful, they drove him to it. I mean, it wasn't him that hurt our children. You want to know who killed him? Gordon. It was all of them. They all wanted him dead. Every damned one of them."
Cyril's voice had risen. Nicky continued to push him. "Please, Mr. Roberts, we really need your help here. If it wasn't Hammond, who do you believe was responsible for terrorizing the children of Quentin?"
"I don't know. Really, I don't."
"Then who did you suspect?" The man looked at her with anguish in his eyes. His voice dropped to a whisper.
"I thought it was one of the older children. But, Inspector, Avril disappeared. And children don't kill other children, do they?"
The tears spilled down his chapped and ruddy cheek. Nicky knew that they did. She said nothing. Yvonne made them all tea, and to calm as Cyril agreed that Nicky could come back another day. Joseph wondered about leaving the old man alone like this, but Cyril assured them he would be fine. He preferred his own company these days. They drove off the fen in silence. Nicky thought about Avril, lying dead beneath the marsh or spirited away, never to be seen again. Was her disappearance and the abuse of the children the work of two different parties? And now there was a new mystery. Nicky sighed. Who was decorating Hammond's grave with dead animals? Lest we forget. Joseph spoke from the back seat.
It has to be someone who knows that pets and other animals went missing at that time.
Which could be absolutely anyone in the area, or anyone able to read a local paper.
Nicky groaned. This is one right royal jumblement, as we say here in the country. Yvonne was driving. She gazed at the road ahead and began to reminisce.
Barnsley was so frustrated with the Fenlanders, he threatened to arrest half of them for wasting police time, and the other half with attempting to pervert the court of justice. He was almost tearing his hair out. Well, we all were, but I was much younger. And I guess what had been done to those children affected a family man like him, with kids of his own, more than a young'un like me.
Looks like the villagers haven't changed much. That wasn't the most successful trip we've ever had.
Joseph bit his lip.
That poor old guy. All on his own out there. I know he said that's how he likes it, but it doesn't seem right somehow.
It doesn't, does it? Yvonne said. If he had a nice little place like Sergeant Barnes has got, with friendly faces around him and plenty to do, I'm sure he'd finish off his days with a bit of enjoyment in his life.
Nicky had great respect for people who did their best to look after themselves. She thought of the pots of flowers and the washing on the line. It reminded her of her grandmother's house, all spick and span, even though the old lady's hands were knotted with rheumatoid arthritis. She dragged her thoughts back to the present.
When we get back, I think we should write up our reports and walk away from this for a few hours. I'm finding it all very confusing, to say the least. We'll hear what Cat has to tell us, and then we'll all go down to the Riverside Cafe, and I'll treat us to lunch. On one condition. No one is to mention Quinton bloody O'Dyke.
Cyril Roberts sat in his kitchen and stared unseeing at his newspaper. He could not concentrate, no matter how hard he tried. The past was drumming relentlessly in his head. He had always known that one day the police would come a-calling, but their visit had brought the past rushing back like it all happened just yesterday.
"Read that!"
His wife sent the sheet of neatly written notepaper skidding across the table towards him.
"That finishes it. I'm not letting her go round with that Avril Hammond any more."
"What on earth has little Avril got to do with this, for heaven's sake? Oh, lass and her are best friends."
He read through the head teacher's report. It was not good.
"Cyril Roberts, you are the only man in this village that has a good word to say for that evil beast Hammond.
If you're not careful and don't stop defending him, they'll reckon you're in cahoots with him."
He plonked himself down on the kitchen chair and shook his head. "All this says is that her schoolwork is flagging a bit, that she seems to have lost her previous enthusiasm and her marks are lower than usual. Maybe she's feeling a bit run down. She did have a nasty bout of tonsillitis last month.
And maybe that Gordon Hammond has been hanging around her. For God's sake, man, she's as silent as a church mouse. Haven't you even noticed that?"
She was going too far. He leapt to his feet and pushed his face close to hers.
"And maybe you have been spending too much time listening to the village gossips, woman. He'd no more touch our girl than he would his own bairn, so shut it."
He crumpled up the report and threw it into the grate.
"I'll talk to her, and I'll be having the truth from her, not a load of suspicious lies. Unless you've already poisoned her mind against Gordon. Well, have you?"
Her eyes grew big, and her mouth fell open. He had never spoken to her like that before, and he was regretting it already. Before she could say another word, he turned his back on her and almost ran from the house. Out in the garden, he leant against the side of the potting shed and gasped for breath. He could feel the tears burning behind his eyelids. He couldn't cry. He mustn't. The last time he'd cried was when his little girl was born, 8 years ago. This dreadful business was really getting to him. It was Bert Gilmore that had sown the seed, one night at an after-hours meeting at the local pub, and it was growing fast. New shoots were springing up all over the village. By now it seemed to him as if his wife might be right. He was the only one to have doubts. He pulled his jacket close around him and walked over to the chicken coop. He curled his fingers through the chicken wire and watched the birds pecking and scratching at the hard ground. The feathers of his favourite bantam gleamed. He would never admit it to anyone, least of all his wife, but even he had no idea why Gordon Hammond should go sneaking off onto the marsh before dawn, carrying a bulky sack, and return an hour later with the dirty sacking folded and tucked under his arm. Cyril gave a little moan and leant forward, his head in his hands. Would it ever end, he wondered. Would he hear the truth about what happened before he went to meet his maker? Still, there had been something about that detective inspector that made him think it might just happen. Chapter 14. That afternoon, Superintendent Greg Woodall called Nicky and Jill Mercer into his office.
"I have a problem, and I need your help."
He leaned forward, and his face was creased with worry lines.
"The murders of Madeline Prospero and Louise Lawson have caused a great deal of concern in the higher echelons."
He drew in a long breath.
"There is considerable pressure on me to clear up these two cases as fast and as quietly as possible."
Nicky interrupted. "But, sir, we've been held back, haven't we? Because of the names on that list I gave you."
"I'm well aware of that, Nicky. That list is the cause of some very serious issues."
He sat back.
"The two deaths are connected, are they not?"
Both inspectors nodded.
"Without a doubt, sir," said Jill. "And unless we get some leads on the killer, another woman from or affiliated in some way to the Bribe Hatch Club could well be next."
"So you believe that someone is targeting the club members?"
Nicky nodded.
"It seems like that, although we have no idea of the motive. We have interviewed any number of people close to them, and no one is setting off alarm bells,"
added Jill.
"There is a meeting of the club on Monday night, sir. Our source is going along and will report back to us immediately afterwards."
Nicky paused, wondering whether she should tell him about her mother. She decided not to.
"And we will pass on anything relevant to you, sir." "Please do. I suggest that you push your cold case onto the back burner, Nicky, until we get some results with Prospero and Lawson. And leave any sudden deaths to Uniform or those DCs who are covering lower priority stuff."
Nicky inwardly growled. She didn't want to lose their momentum now.
"I don't believe that the Hammond case is quite as cold as we first thought, sir. I'm pretty certain that it's going to jump up and bite us at any moment. Someone has just gone to great lengths to remind us about Hammond."
She told Greg about the dead rabbits at St. Augustine's. "So I'd really like to leave at least one officer keeping the ball rolling, sir."
"If you must, but get everyone else moving as fast as you can on the Bribe Hatch case."
He handed them both a typed memo.
"Now, there are some people listed here that I do not want you to question. I repeat, do not involve these women. This is a security matter. One of them, as you already know, is involved in an internal investigation at a very high level."
He rubbed at his chin.
"I don't have to tell you to be as discreet as possible. Tread very, very carefully. We don't want anyone making allegations against us."
"What if we find that one of these elite women has something to do with the deaths?"
Jill Mercer asked.
Do not approach them yourselves. Come directly to me, and I will take it from there. Understood?
Finally, Jill and Nicky were released.
Phew! He's really been put through the mill, hasn't he?
Jill Mercer murmured.
I'll say. Poor guy looked strung out.
So how do we play this?
Nicky grimaced.
I suggest you come down to my grotto and we'll plan a strategy.
Maria Lawson is in a terrible state, said Jill. I've done all I can, but I'm getting nowhere. I feel sure the two cases are connected, but how? The only common factor is the Briar Patch Club.
As they walked down the stairs, Nicky heard voices coming up from the landing below. She held out her hand to stop Jill going any further down, and they both listened.
Don't know why we have to have a load of high-tech computer boffins here in the first place. Probably comes out of our bloody budget.
Yeah, and have you seen the butch little civvy who's going to be running it?
Another todger dodger. If you ask me, they just need a good seeing to. Show 'em what they're missing. Hey, do you know the definition of a dyke?
Nicky quickly stepped down to the landing.
Yes, a woman who is smart enough to know she doesn't need a man like you in her life.
She glared from one of the officers to the other.
I suggest the two of you keep your bigoted opinions to yourselves, unless you fancy being up to your todgers in hot water.
The two men looked shocked at her outburst.
Sorry, ma'am. Just a bit of fun.
Well, I'm not amused,
Jill Mercer growled.
They get lost.
As the two women walked on down the stairs to the basement, Jill gave a low chuckle.
Looks like you and I will now be getting a few new nicknames.
Nicky shook her head and grinned.
We'll cope.
She ushered Jill into her new quarters.
Oh, this is very interesting. Would that be the clock that went missing from the men's room?
Jill grinned.
How on earth would I know that? It's not a place I frequent, actually.
Nicky attempted to keep a straight face.
Me neither, but my lads have been going on about it for days.
Every time I walk in here, I find something new. I'm beginning to dread what might be coming next.
Nicky glanced at Dave.
Jill grinned. As long as it's not that big picture in the silver frame of the super's wife, you should be fine.
Want a coffee? Just please don't tell me it's your coffee machine.
Love one, and no, I've never seen it before.
Jill sat down at Nicky's desk.
I know I'm short-staffed, but even so, by now I should be following leads, not on the killer's trail. But like hell I am.
She shrugged.
CCTV has given us nothing. And you know what Bedsitland is like. That area by the college could be Grand Central Station for the amount of footfall there.
Nicky nodded.
And everyone loved the kid, right?
Not an enemy in the world. Bar one, of course.
Jill smiled.
And the PM results aren't back yet, so we are screwed on that front.
Not exactly.
There was Rory standing in the doorway.
Any more of that delicious-smelling coffee on offer?
Only if you come bearing gifts.
Nicky pointed to an empty chair and poured him a coffee.
So, what have you got for us?
Something very important, actually. Louise Lawson. You will see from the tox report that our young victim had been drinking before she was killed. Not heavily, just a sociable glass of dry white wine. Quite a pleasant sancerre, in fact. She appears to have been quite relaxed before she was knocked unconscious. No struggle, no defensive wounds.
She knew her assailant?
Asked Jill.
Can't be sure, but it looks that way. But here's the main thing. When I was examining her, I noticed a tiny smudge on her cheek. It was so small, I almost missed it. Given all the other terrible injuries, it was amazing I even saw it, but it just stood out somehow. I took a swab when I did the external examination, and then forgot about it until all the test results came back. It was lipstick, but not the same colour as the one on her lips. And there was nothing in the flat even nearly like it. One of my technicians has traced the suppliers. You'll find the make and shade, along with a list of local stockists in the details. Midnight Orchid, I think it was called.
Could you get any DNA from it?
Nicky was leaning forward in her chair.
No, not from that. There was no saliva and no skin cells, just pure lipstick. We have plenty of other DNA, though. We are running a comparison check with samples that we collected from the Prospero crime scene. If we get a typing match, it would confirm it was the same killer. And who's to say, the murderer might just wear Midnight Orchid.
The woman?
Nicky and Jill spoke in unison.
Or a trans person, dear hearts. It was a very fetching colour. A sort of deep merlot.
Nicky's eyes were wide,
No, seriously, are you telling us that the findings indicate a female killer?